Today at Reader's Corner, Adam Rome, author of The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation.
There had been concern about environmental issues before, but it didn't really coalesce. It really didn't become one big thing until Earth Day. Tens and tens of thousands of people all across the country, most of them young, became the local organizers, the grassroots organizers of 12 or 13,000 Earth Day events. Although there's much greater environmental infrastructure now, solving the kinds of problems we have today, which are not just environmental problems, they're economic problems, social problems, political problems, it's going to take the creativity and commitment of all kinds of people in all kinds of professions. We can't just expect politicians to do it.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Earth Day 2014 is Tuesday, and celebrations are planned across our nation and across the world. 44 years after it was first launched, this annual event continues to evolve, attract new participants, and raise awareness about environmental issues. What many may not realize is that Earth Day also played a major role in the rise of the modern environmental movement. Today's guest, prize-winning historian Adam Rome, writes about the history and legacy of Earth Day in his book, The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. Organized by a handful of young people, inaugural Earth Day events around the country drew tens of thousands of participants. Through teach-ins, protests, and other activities, Earth Day organized and mobilized a generation of environmental activists. It also was the spark for far-reaching legislation on clean air, clean water, endangered species, and even the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. Dr. Rome teaches environmental history and environmental nonfiction at the University of Delaware. Before earning his Ph.D. in history, he worked for 7 years as a journalist. His first book, The Bulldozer in the Countryside, Suburban Sprawl and the Rise of American Environmentalism, won the Frederick Jackson Turner Award and the Lewis Mumford Prize. Dr. Rome joins us by phone for this interview. Adam Rome, welcome to Reader's Corner.
It's a super pleasure to be here.
You refer to Earth Day 1970 as the most famous little-known event in modern American history. Why is that?
Well, everyone's heard of Earth Day, and most people know that it started a long time ago, and they may even know that it was influential, but hardly anyone really knew anything about how it was organized or what actually happened on that day until I began to look into it. So it's famous but little known.
I wonder, given this issue of the fact that it's the most famous little-known event, how it's treated in the typical high school American history text. I'm sure that in those texts, you'll find significant markers regarding the Vietnam War, regarding campus protests of various kinds in the 1960s and the 1970s. Does Earth Day get the same kind of focus that the Vietnam War and civil rights markers get in American, let's just say, high school history books?
I don't think so. In fact, just 10 days ago, I was leading a workshop for school teachers in Massachusetts, and they indicated that they didn't really have anything much to say about it in their regular courses. That's why they were signed up for this workshop, to learn more about Earth Day and the environmental movement. And that is odd, as you say, because Earth Day dwarfed any of the big anti-Vietnam War protests of the 60s, any of the civil rights protests. It was many, many times bigger. But I think it hasn't gotten its due because people have assumed that it was just symbolic, just a kind of media event, a series of playful protests all over the country, rather than a really serious grappling with what people at the time called the environmental crisis, the overwhelming sense that the nation's environment was deteriorating, that if we didn't do something to stop, that might ultimately threaten the survival of our country, our civilization. So Earth Day really doesn't get the attention that it deserves, but hopefully that'll change.
And remind us of what folks were worried about in the 1960s as they approached this Earth Day 1970. What was going on in our country from an environmental perspective that caused them to rise up and create this event?
It is kind of hard to imagine just how much worse our environment was then, because we've done a lot to clean it up in the 44 years since the first Earth Day was celebrated. In almost every city, especially cities that relied a lot on coal, the air was visibly polluted, or from cars, like in Los Angeles. There'd be black clouds. Even in Pittsburgh, some days the middle of the day would be like an eclipse. You couldn't see the sky from the pollution. The water is all over the country visibly polluted. People were talking about the Great Lakes dying, rivers catching on fire in Cleveland, oil spills off the coast of California. The first of what has turned out, unfortunately, to be many, many disastrous oil spills was in 1969. People were worried about sprawl. There was, with the tremendous affluence that came after World War II, suburbia grew and grew and grew, and people worried about the loss of open space. They were worried that there might just be too many people, that we couldn't continue indefinitely to support an ever-growing population with the resources of a finite planet. They were beginning to worry about what we now call hazardous waste or toxic waste. There's a whole slew of problems, but especially pollution, I think, really was an everyday thing, and it was also something that ruined people's vacations. You'd go out, you'd want to spend beautiful time along the river, just like you're on your campus, you've got the beautiful river right there. But in many places, the rivers stank. You couldn't swim in them. You couldn't fish in them. So people were really upset, and they saw things getting worse.
So how does the Vietnam War contribute to the rise of environmental awareness and protest?
What we now call the environmental movement sprang from a whole host of different roots. There had been concern about environmental issues before, but it didn't really coalesce. It really didn't become one big thing until Earth Day. One of the strands definitely was young people questioning the whole direction of the country, and Vietnam was a big part of that. So some of the Earth Day activists thought we were destroying literally the land of Vietnam. People later wrote about it in terms of ecocide, what we did to the landscape in the course of that war. And people saw analogies with what we were doing here at home. And in many cases, it was the same companies that were producing the chemicals that we used domestically and the weapons that we used abroad. So there definitely was a sense, I think, among young people that the country was headed in the wrong direction, and the environment was a big part of it. But it wasn't the only part of it. There were a lot of young people that thought we needed radical change. But Earth Day was a big tent. Earth Day attracted all kinds of different people. So it included a lot of other people who were supporters of the war, who thought of themselves as conservative or apolitical. That was part of the genius of the day, to be able to bring together so many different kinds of folks.
But is it fair to say that young people really served as the catalyst to kick off this movement?
Well, yes and no. Earth Day overwhelmingly was the work of young people, but the idea for it, and this continues to amaze me, was a 50-something senator from Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson. And his story, I think, is a fabulous story. He'd been governor of Wisconsin from 1959 to 63. He'd been interested in a lot of things, but as governor, he came to conclude that environmental issues were the great challenge of the decade to come. And then when he was elected to the Senate in 63, he devoted his whole Senate career from 63 to 70, unsuccessfully, to trying to put the environment on the national agenda. He got the President Kennedy to take a national tour to try to dramatize the issues. That didn't work. He introduced legislation in the Senate, but none of it passed. But finally, he was inspired by young anti-war activists who had come up with this new technique in the mid-60s called the teach-in on college campuses, where they were extracurricular educational events with a political overtone. They were usually in the evening, and they gave the war's opponents a chance to debate with war supporters about the war. And he thought young people could adapt that teach-in model to the environment and really bring change to the country in the same way they'd begun to change the country with civil rights and with the war. And he was right. He issued a call, said he was going to try to organize a nationwide teach-in on the environment in spring 1970. And ultimately, tens and tens of thousands of people all across the country, most of them young, most of them teenagers or 20-somethings, became the local organizers, the grassroots organizers of 12 or 13,000 Earth Day events, virtually every college, virtually every K-12 school, and many, many community events. So young people were key, but an establishment figure was the catalyst. And I think that really made Earth Day different than many of the other events of the time. which were either top-down or bottom-up. Earth Day was both. Earth Day had the power that Gaylord Nelson brought to the table with the creativity and the commitment of the grassroots. Mm-hmm.
Well, certainly Gaylord Nelson was a mainstream politician in his day, but he was also, as far as Wisconsin is concerned, the son of the famous progressive movement that came out of Wisconsin, wasn't he?
Yeah, I tell one story, which was told by his biographer. In the 30s, when he was coming of age, his dad took him to hear one of the two great Wisconsin progressive politicians, both La Follette, father and son. And his dad said, you know, maybe you'd be interested in being a politician. And Gaylord Nelson said, well, I don't know if there'll be any problems left to solve when I'm an adult, because the progressive spirit was can do, government can help people solve their problems. And Nelson was a classic northern liberal of that time. He really did believe government had great power to do good. And he supported civil rights. He supported unions. He ultimately was a relative minority within the Democratic Party because he was one of the first to oppose the Vietnam War. But he was interested in the full array of liberal issues of the time. And he also really believed that there were a lot of goods, people called them public goods, that only government or the community could provide. They weren't things you could go out to a store and buy, like clean air. And so he had that classic liberal sense, can-do sense that government could be a force for good.
Today we're talking with Adam Rome, the author of The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. And what struck me about your treatment of Senator Gaylord Nelson was just how far Wisconsin has come from the ideals that he stood for. Just the other day, the New York Times ran an article about the fight for Wisconsin's soul, in which they discuss Governor Scott Walker's okaying the permitting of an iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin. It's going to be 4 miles long. It's an open pit up to a half mile wide, 1,000 feet deep, could extend as long as 21 miles. It's in the footprint of the headwaters of a major river up there. It has enormous potential to destroy the environment, drinking water of a number of communities. And after what we've seen in West Virginia, that has to be particularly troubling to the people of northern Wisconsin. But I'm reading your book, and I'm thinking, yeah, okay, and you've just said it. We've made some improvements since the 60s. The cities were dirty. Our streams were cluttered. But it's not like, from a public policy standpoint, we've reached nirvana here in America when you look back on what Gaylord Nelson stood for and what we're looking at today in either Congress or the state legislatures or governor's offices.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the people, I interviewed a lot of the people that were involved with organizing the first Earth Day. They're now in their 50s or 60s or sometimes 70s. And most of them were still hearteningly out there trying to make a difference, but some of them were a little depressed. You know, they thought, we haven't gotten where we thought we were going to be by now. And no one in 1970, I think, could have envisioned the unbelievably deep partisan divide about environmental issues. Environmental issues in 1970, although liberals like Nelson were more aggressive about raising the issue, they were bipartisan. The president at the time, Richard Nixon, was a Republican. He was the one who created the EPA. He was the one who signed all these pioneering environmental acts, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. Even Ronald Reagan in California in 1970 as governor made a State of the State address that was almost entirely about environmental issues. Conservatives were worried that they were falling behind in trying to think of solutions. They hoped that the solutions would be ones that wouldn't be big government, big tax solutions. But they recognized that these were serious issues. They didn't deny that they were serious issues. They trusted the scientists. They trusted the sense of the people. A lot of that has changed. We had an incredible decade in the 70s of environmental initiatives at every level. But since then, there's been backlash and, I'd say, stalemate, at least politically. It's hard to see major national legislation coming anytime in the foreseeable future about climate change or any of the other issues we're still grappling with. Instead, the initiative is going to have to come in a lot of other places. And in some ways, I think that's part of what's still inspiring about the Earth Day story. All these local organizers, many, many, many of them decided after Earth Day that they wanted to make this their career. And there were no obvious career paths. They had to be very entrepreneurial about finding ways to work on environmental issues. Some of them were in government, some of them were in nonprofits, some of them were in education or traditional professions, but they had to carve out ways of doing things. And I think that's still true, although there's a much greater environmental infrastructure now. Solving the kinds of problems we have today, which are not just environmental problems, they're economic problems, social problems, political problems, it's going to take the creativity and commitment of all kinds of people in all kinds of professions. We can't just expect politicians to do it.
I'm really glad you mentioned that point about Republican President Richard Nixon signing the EPA law. I think that's one of the things that we sometimes forget in recent history is that the 1970s and Republican leadership was activist in the area of the environment, and that's almost flipped now to the point where it's really difficult to get that kind of support from the Republican Party. But let's talk about the Earth Day of 1970 and the Earth Day of 1990, and the Earth Day of today. What's going to happen? What's going to happen later this month? How has the event changed, and does that have any impact on policy in any substantial way?
Gaylord Nelson originally didn't envision Earth Day being anything but a one-time event. That he was hoping that it would galvanize the country, put the environment on the national agenda. And it did. Earth Day succeeded far, far more than he dreamed. He would have originally been happy if just 40 schools around the country had really, really great events. And instead it was 12, 13,000. So after Earth Day, he decided that he would try to make it an annual event, which ironically he called Earth Week. He wanted to distinguish it from the first one. And he thought kids in school and reporters in the media and politicians could take stock of how much progress we'd made or not made in the past year in dealing with our environmental issues. And after 1970, Earth Day ebbed and flowed in different places. Some places celebrated every year. Some places dropped out of the annual calendar. In 1990, on the 20th anniversary, and it wasn't just that it was the 20th anniversary, the issue of climate change, although scientists had been talking about it for decades, only really became a public issue in 1989. That was when the first scientist testified before Congress that this was a serious issue. It was when Bill McKibben wrote the first popular book about climate change. So in 1990, some of the organizers of the first Earth Day, some of the young organizers, decided they would try to again have a national event. And in fact, an international event, they really made a big push to internationalize it. And that was hugely successful. They got something like 200 other countries to have Earth Day celebrations. And some of the celebrations in the U.S. were much bigger than the 1970 ones, but it didn't have the lasting impact for lots and lots of reasons. But I think part of it was that the organizers, and this is still true of a lot of environmentalists today, they think that the problems are clear and the solutions are clear and all that's involved is the will to act. But I don't think that's actually true. I think part of the genius of the first Earth Day was that it was an educational event, that it really forced people to do what the New York Times called soul-searching, to ask really difficult questions, and they were free to come up with their own answers about how deep the problems went and what really would be needed to solve the problems and what you could do as an individual or as a citizen or in your job to make a difference. I think that kind of soul-searching, that kind of questioning has been missing. Earth Day now is, in most places, it's either a trade fair, it's a chance to see the latest new green consumer products or the green goods, or in schools, it's often a corporate-sponsored day of environmental consciousness. And I've changed my mind about what Earth Day could be in the future. I think when I was working on the book, I had the sense that no Earth Day ever again could match the intensity, the freshness, the power of the 1970 event. And that's probably true nationally, but I don't think it's true locally. And in fact, I was in St. Paul, Minnesota at McAllister College in February, where a senior seminar in environmental studies for their whole project was going to try to reinvent Earth Day for the 21st century. That was what their whole class was about. Earth Day Revival, they call it. And I think they're doing something really fascinating. I think they're trying to figure out, in an age when people often think they know about the issues or they know what they think about the issues, how do you break through? How do you get people to think in new ways, to ask new questions? That, I think, can be a much bigger part of Earth Day than it is currently. But I think it would have to start locally. I think it would have to start with people on individual campuses or in individual communities deciding that these questions are still worth asking, and that if we ask them, we might change history.
Well, I know your book doesn't deal with this, but it would be fascinating to attempt to measure the media attention that is given to this event, say in 1970, in the early years of the Earth Day movement, to how much attention it gets on the evening news in a city like Boise in 2014. And this is a question I can ask you, the extent to which social media promotes this event or engages this event in ways that, of course, didn't exist in 1990 or 1970.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the places where, at least with the traditional media, I think we've taken a step back. The first Earth Day led to an explosion of media coverage. All the major national networks, and at the time there were only four, did Earth Day specials, sometimes multiple specials. The Today Show devoted its entire programming for the week, 10 hours, to essentially a televised teach-in on the environment. That was also true for local television and radio stations. Newspapers gave it tremendous coverage. And after Earth Day, a tremendous number of newspapers and magazines and a few TV stations decided that they were going to have to cover the environment as a regular beat, that they would have to devote the time of a reporter and even an editor to routine coverage, day-to-day coverage of this. And that continued to build. The number of environmental reporters continued to grow. There's a society of environmental journalists now with over 1,500 members. Earth Day 1990 gave another huge push. There was another huge wave of environmental coverage that lasted for years after that. But in recent years, I think in the traditional media, a lot of those environmental beats have been dropped. And you're right, you don't see nearly as much coverage on the mainstream television stations. There's a few exceptions among radio, and you don't see it as much in daily newspapers, although some still have environmental reporters. But there's a whole range of alternative media, I think, that's beginning to fill some of that gap. There's a tremendous number of online magazines or news outlets, and there also, as you suggested, are all kinds of creative ways that people are using social media to network and to share information. The students in McAllister, their vision, part of it is that they could begin to work with students at other universities to figure out which ideas are the best, which ideas are working if you want to revive Earth Day. So the traditional media, I think, isn't doing its job on environment, but there have begun to be a variety of alternative sources that, if you want to, you can find out. And that's a big difference. Back in the old days, you know, when there were so few media choices, whatever decisions they made about what to cover shaped what most people knew or didn't know. Now it's more up to you to decide what you want to know about, and that has advantages and disadvantages.
Today we're talking with Adam Rome, the author of The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. I mean, in one sense, the media is only driven by those who want to use the media. These days especially, I mean, newspapers have cut back on reporting and news analysis, and I'm not so sure TV and radio is much better, especially radio, except for, of course, NPR. So what you have going here is a very decentralized operation, almost like the Internet. Who's in charge? No one's in charge. So it's not like there can be a grand national strategy on how we're going to reassert the influence of Earth Day by doing this and doing that. It is, isn't it, still kind of a grassroots effort and therefore very difficult to organize from a central standpoint?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think before I started to work on Earth Day, I just would have been depressed by that. That our natural instinct is to hope that one leader, or whether it's in politics or the media or in business, could really do something decisive that would catalyze big change. And that does sometimes happen. But what I learned from the Earth Day story was that Gaylor Nelson trusted that local people would come up with meaningful ways of doing something on Earth Day. He didn't insist that they do any one thing. He didn't even insist that they look at legislation as a solution, even though that was what he personally cared about the most. And so we tend to think of that as disorganized, chaotic, that you can't get any momentum out of that. And that might be true if the problem has to be solved next month or even 6 months or a year from now. But I think if you're trying to work with problems that aren't going away, like climate change, there are going to be challenges for all of us for the rest of our lives. The kind of decentralized effort where individual people get to figure out for themselves how they can make a difference if they want to, that has really lasting power. And I think the idea that people could make a commitment and try to year after year figure out what they can do and change as circumstances change what they think they can do, that turned out to be really powerful. That's why I think Earth Day gave rise to a whole generation of people, thousands and thousands of people committed to working on these issues in all kinds of different ways. And we still need that. We may need it even more than we did in 1970, just for the reasons you mentioned, because there's not going to be very much top-down initiative.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to rely on lots and lots of people working in lots of different ways that are uncoordinated, but ultimately might be incredibly powerful.
Well, just to show everyone what we're up against, I think it was the New Yorker that reviewed your book and said, "We're as distant from Earth Day as the Battle of Gettysburg was from James Monroe's re-election, and Rome evokes a United States that feels politically like a foreign country." Boy, do you go that far in agreeing with the New York on your book?
Yeah, the Nicholas Lehman piece, of course, that made my day. It's every writer's dream.
Exactly.
Written about,
I guess,
in the New Yorker. and the idea that I brought to life this past age. I don't know if I would say it's a foreign country, but it was a very different world. It was a world where even though people were grappling with really quite serious, devastating problems, tearing the country apart, like Vietnam, as well as all these environmental issues, the beginnings of feminism, there was a tremendous positive spirit. And that is especially true for young people. I think I'm kind of amazed, and you might even appreciate it as a college president, some of the presidents of the institutions, you know, there's a time of campus unrest. Some of them were worried that Earth Day could be another unruly thing, maybe even violent. But many of them
take
gave
over their offices.
Blessings to the young people who organized Earth Day events, even gave them money in order to make a bigger and better Earth Day. They trusted people, and I think that sense that young people had themselves and that the most enlightened adults also had, that they could really do something if they were given the freedom and the opportunity. In our more uncertain, anxious age, I think a lot of young people are just much less willing to take risks and take chances, and they're less optimistic that if they do, anything really lasting will come. So maybe in that sense, it is a little bit of a different country. I don't think it's going to be that way always. I have hope. When you talk one-on-one with students, it's amazing how energized they can be and how much they can inspire you. But I think that's one of the biggest differences, that the country as a whole still had a sense that the future was going to be better despite great problems, and I'm not sure we have that now in the same way.
Well, your comment on college presidents, we'll put up with a lot of things, but when you talk about taking over our offices, now that's where we draw the line. Adam, we've run out of time, but I really do appreciate your joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation, by Adam Rome. Adam, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. This was a great discussion.
Next week, Amanda Ripley, author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, researched by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.